Hello and welcome back. It's great to see all of you again. This is Chapter 5, The Yoga of Renunciation, in the series entitled The Gita Decoded. Sister Denise has been sharing her wisdom and insight into all the previous chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, what it means and what its significance is in the life that we lead today in the 21st century. Sister Denise, very warm welcome back.
Thank you.
So, The Yoga of Renunciation. Could you tell me why is it that renunciation is mentioned again, since it was mentioned in the previous chapters?
I believe that the Gita was made like different sections by different people at different times and at some point codified and put together. So I think that you've got a number of intellects looking at the same issue from a number of different angles. In that sense, it's an eponymous scripture, which many of them are. The other thing is that it's very subtle, and you're looking at something in comparison with something else in order to see it, the system of a foil. In the Raj Yoga that is practiced within the Brahma Kumaris system, we use the word tyag. And we say, you have to have tyag, and then you have tapasya, and then there can be seva. So tyag, tapasya, seva. Tyag means renunciation, because without renunciation you can't really have yoga, so tapasya meaning intense yoga, and without those two you cannot serve. So in the Gita it speaks about action for world benefit, so we use the word seva for that. To take a look at the question of tyag by itself is actually very helpful, very insightful. So let's look at what is really the renunciation that prepares the soul for yoga.
The chapter starts with Arjuna asking God which is superior, yoga or renunciation of actions. The reply that is given is in verse 2, which reads, "The Blessed Lord spoke, both renunciation and the yoga of action lead to incomparable bliss. Of the two, however, the yoga of action is superior to the renunciation of action." What do these terms mean?
I think it's a further extrapolation of what we saw in book 4. Renunciation of karma, karma sannyas, is a kind of an avoidance. If you can't do the right thing, do nothing at all, kind of thing. Whereas what is superior is act, but act so accurately that that action is renunciation, but you haven't renounced action, but you have renounced the involvement, the attachment, the emotional issues that arise with action, the possibility of temptation, and so on.
May I interject, Sister Denise? The theory of what you just said and what is contained herein makes a lot of sense. But what does this mean practically?
What it means practically, I think, is you say, okay, I am a person who wishes to focus on my spiritual development, as opposed to focus on developing myself materialistically. So what you're renouncing is the purpose of life, which is described in materialism, is I'm here for the purpose of experiencing happiness right here, right now. The renunciation is a kind of investment, and that means I'm investing in myself with a view that my karma will be such that over the long, long period of time, I will be experiencing all kinds of positive energies, all kinds of fortune. You know, it says renunciation, but it's really more like you're you're not taking the fruit of your action unripe. You're waiting until it really matures. Like in any investment, if you wait till it matures, you get a much better return than if you take it quickly.
Sister Denise, verse 3 reads, "He is to be known as the eternal sannyasi, who neither hates nor desires, who is indifferent to the pairs of opposites, O Arjuna. He is easily liberated from bondage." What is meant by eternal sannyasi?
I think what it means is that you're renouncing something that you can continue to renounce over a long period of time. For example, in the practice that we do in the Brahma Kumaris Raj Yoga, we talk about the different disciplines that you give up. For example, we practice to be vegetarian. You won't die from being vegetarian. You can continue to be vegetarian for the rest of your life. So this is considered as a permanent kind of renunciation of non-vegetarian food. So like that, there are certain practices that we do which is not just for a certain time. A contrasting thing would be if you do an austerity, like you're going to say, okay, I'm going to sit in a cave for 90 days and meditate. You know, at the end of 90 days, you come out. So it's temporary. So it's a renunciation on a physical level, which you can't continue for the whole life. Whereas the eternal sannyasi is he has renounced certain lifestyle permanently. I mean, some people, they say, okay, we're going to renounce food, we're going to do fasting. You can't fast until death, because then you'll die. But if you fast from certain kinds of food, you can keep that up for your whole life.
Sister Denise, I did note with some interest that the sixth verse reads as follows: "Renunciation indeed, O Arjuna, is difficult to attain without yoga. The sage who is disciplined in yoga quickly attains Brahman." I was relieved to see it being written in black and white that it is difficult to attain without yoga, that is renunciation. Knowing that it's difficult, what should a sincere effort maker do?
I'll just give you from my own experience. When I began the practice of Raj Yoga, it was not told to me that this is easy Raj Yoga, although the Brahma Kumaris Raj Yoga is called Sahaj Raj Yoga, easy Raj Yoga. But I was coming to it thinking that it's really difficult to do this, because my mentality, my personality is the type that says, if it's easy, it's not worth doing. If it's difficult, it means that if you can do it, you've really achieved something. So I would actually be the kind of person who would choose the difficult thing with the thought that you attain something almost unattainable. That's very special, that's worth it.
Sister Denise, please explain what verse 7 means, and I specifically refer to line 1 and 2, which reads, "He who is devoted to yoga, whose self is purified, whose self is subdued, whose senses are conquered, whose self has become the self of all beings, is not tainted even when acting." What is meant by subduing the self? And I ask this question in context of an answer that you gave in one of the earlier episodes, where you said to suppress or repress any trait is very dangerous.
Right, that's right, I did. What I'm also noticing is the word self is written with a small s here.
Yeah.
You know, in Brahma Kumaris Raj Yoga, we talk about soul conscious and body conscious states of being. So I think to subdue the self in this particular shloka means to overcome the body consciousness, to keep the false ego in check. And that requires a good, strong mind, a good, strong intellect. You know, if you try to do it by force, you're using physical power, and you can't keep it up. If you have yoga and you're using spiritual power, you can apply spiritual power to that and sustain it, and you're not doing any kind of violence, or you're not using physical energy to suppress it. So I think I would interpret it that way.
Sister Denise, you know what concerns me about this particular verse? Mm. We live in a physical body. We have to be in it. We speak from it, from inside it. We act. How are you able to do this and still enjoy life? Because this takes constant, rigid attention, total attention.
I think it does if you don't have yoga. But if you do have yoga, it becomes the way you are. You do this because you have the strength to do it, not because you have to keep applying force to it. This is a real difference between the angle of Hatha Yoga, which literally means yoga by force, and Raja Yoga, which means the yoga of mastery. When you're a master, you know, it's like somebody who's really skilled at something, they do it with ease. You never feel they're making any effort. Mm-hmm. And so when we use the term spiritual effort, which we do use, the Hindi word that we will use for that is purusharat. And I will interpret that word not to mean effort, which implies this force, you know. I would say, divide the word into two. Arat means something like for the sake of. So anything that you do for the sake of yourself, that is spiritual effort. But you see, you acquire this mastery, you gain the skill, you have the ease of the skilled person. It becomes a very natural effort.
I see that in verse 8, 9, and 10, there is once again a teaching, a lesson on neutrality. How does that fit within the context of chapter 5?
Well, chapter 5, you're talking about the difference between karma sannyas and yoga, renunciation through yoga. So when you are having karma sannyas, I think you're bringing up perhaps a negative energy where you dislike something. You know what happens to people? They say, okay, I'm a smoker, I want to give up smoking, I'm going to make a New Year's resolution, I'll give up smoking. You kind of force yourself to give it up, and you can't keep it up very long. And then when you have the power, the spiritual power, your energy changes. The way that you deal with stress changes. When a person is responding to stress, using a coping mechanism which has an addictive aspect to it, like smoking is an interesting example. Tobacco is a substance that people use to calm down, because if they don't have that, they can't calm down. And why it's called addictive is because you need more and more to get the same amount of calm, which means your ability to calm yourself is getting weaker and weaker, which means your personal power is getting taken away by this other use of a mind-altering substance. When you're doing yoga, you're taking energy from the Supreme Being, adding that to your energy and changing your energy from being okay to a certain point to being very okay, or even to be quite capable of managing your feelings.
Sister Denise, I see the imagery that is used in verse 10 is a lotus leaf by the water.
Mm-hmm.
And the word evil is used in the sentence before that. What does that mean to you?
The image of the world as a dirty pond with lotuses growing in it is quite a traditional one. When you see a lotus pond, you see the lotus flowers above the water individually, and there's various lotus leaves also sticking up. And you don't see the water, you know, the water it's growing in is stagnant, dirty, and under the water, the lotus roots are very, very connected with each other and entwined and entangled with each other. But the lotus is used to refer to a person who is in the world but not of the world. So you are a person who's in the world, you're detached, you're free, you're individual, you're independent, and behind that appearance you have all your connections, but you're not constrained or in bondage or anything. You have your freedom. Mm-hmm. So this lotus example is very often used. You'll see in Buddhism the lotus everywhere. The Buddha's sitting on a lotus. All the Hindu gods and goddesses, they're also sitting on lotuses or standing, you know. Mm. So and the lotus is one of the weapons of Vishnu. It's a weapon. How a flower becomes a weapon is because when you are in that position of detachment, you're unassailable.
Mm, I like that term, unassailable. Very powerful. Sister Denise, I'm now moving on to verse 11, which reads, "The yogins perform action towards self-purification." I find that term very interesting, and I'm looking at it particularly in light of the resistance that a yogin faces in this world that pulls you into impurity. I asked this question in an earlier episode in a different context, but this word self-purification, I mean, there is nothing in this world that's remotely pure. The yogin has this noble intention and is facing that amount of resistance. It's like the glow of a tiny firefly in a world full of darkness.
When you have a great amount of darkness and there's a little light in it, what are you looking at? Looking at that little light.
How does the yogin achieve self-purification, having abandoned attachment?
Okay, let's look at the word purging. An analogy that we use in Brahma Kumaris for purification is gold. When gold has alloy mixed into it, if you want to extract the alloy and get left with just the pure gold, you have to keep it in a crucible and you have to put it in great heat so that the alloy burns off. And I think this is really what the yogin is doing. A yogin means somebody who stays in yoga. And yoga is also considered as a fire. When we're born in the karmic consequences of some previous lives. And so we're caught in this, you can say, this impurity that we are here in these certain bondages because we must have engaged in one or another kind of impure action of one sort or another. Okay. So you want to remove that alloy from the gold of your soul. And so therefore you engage in different activities, different kinds of yoga, which are going to pull that out. And there's another thing that I would draw your attention to. What we experience when we do very intense yoga, right? For over a very long period of time, very focused, it will cause an access to the deepest part of your consciousness to open up. And that will cause the impurity that's normally buried, hidden away, and not looking like it's there, to actually come from your subconscious to your conscious mind. And that may cause you distress or disturbance or horror, because you say, well, I never knew that I was capable of this kind of thinking, feeling, or whatever, but here it is, what do I do with it? It's really a matter of understanding. Sometimes it is said that it corresponds or resembles Ayurvedic medicine. And one of the actual descriptions of God is Vaidyanath, you know, the Shiva Lingam of Vaidyanath is that he is the surgeon, the lord of medicine. And what does medicine do is it causes the deep hidden illness to come to the surface, because you cannot deal with things that are in your subconscious. You don't have access to it. But what very intense yoga will do is bring it to your conscious mind, and then you have to say, okay, now I have to deal with this, because this darkness is within me. And it's kind of purging, you see. And you have to let it come out, because it doesn't belong inside. And I think this shloka is also referring to the fact that this is what yoga is about, getting rid of whatever poison, whatever alloy has come into the soul through negative karma over many incarnations.
Yes, Denise, there's a verse that I'd like to read to you, and I've got more than one question on it. Renouncing all actions with the mind, the embodied one sits happily as the ruler within the city of nine gates, not acting at all, nor causing action. What does it mean to renounce actions with the mind? Can I give you a practical example?
Mm-hmm.
You're living in a neighborhood that has a high crime rate. So you say to yourself before going to work, I need to make sure I lock the windows and the door and put the safety door on and switch on the alarm. And then you get to work and you think, I locked the windows, I locked the door, but did I switch on the alarm or not? It plays on your mind because of the concern for your material possessions. So you're thinking about an action either in future or in the past, but you're thinking about an action. And you thinking about it because it's necessary for your normal day-to-day functioning. So my question to you in this context is, what does it mean when it is said renouncing all actions with the mind? I ask, how is this possible?
I think you have to look at what is meant by karmas and the mind. The mind goes for attraction and repulsion.
Of what?
What you like, what you don't like.
Is that all that it does, Sister Denise?
In the context of this, you see, because the city of nine gates refers to the orifices of your body.
Okay.
Most of which are connected with your sense organs.
I'm going to stop you there. That's quite a bombshell that you dropped about what the mind does. Explain.
The mind is such a thing that it is attracted or repelled, because it's like a sense organ. And so if something is beautiful, it'll go. If something is horrible, it'll be repelled by it, but it's caught up in it, you see.
So whether you like something or someone, you think about it or him or her.
Yeah.
If you don't like something or someone,
yeah,
you still think about it,
yeah,
or her.
If you're neutral, you say, okay, here's somebody, okay, thank you very much, got that, that's it. You don't obsess, you're not caught up in. If you are in love with somebody, you can't think of anything else except that one.
Mm.
Or if you hate somebody, you can't think of anything else except that one. You're not neutral.
True that.
You're completely under the influence of what you are attracted by or repelled by. And the intellect is powerless in the face of that, you see. Mm-hmm. So the yogi has to make the intellect powerful, where the intellect says to the mind, don't go there. And the mind says, okay. Usually it doesn't say okay.
Yes, yes, yes. Sister Denise, I think you and I will have to do an entire episode on the mind, on the intellect, and on the sanskaras, but that's a subject for another day. Unfortunately, we have to say goodbye to our viewers right now. I will be taking up this shloka in the next episode as well, because we haven't gone through it fully. Is there any final thoughts that you'd like to leave the viewer with today?
I think I would like the viewer to really think about what's happening in their own minds and just try and observe whether it's really true what I'm saying, that your mind will just go where you're attracted and where you're repelled. One thing I just wanted to add is that the example you gave had to do with responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
It can shift over to the other part, which is you're afraid.
Mm.
So if you're afraid, your mind will go to where you fear, which to me corresponds with things that you don't like. And so this will create the compulsive thinking, the obsessional thinking. But if you are just thinking about something out of responsibility, you'll think about it to the extent that it's necessary to fulfill the responsibility, and then you'll let it go.
So thank you, Sister Denise, for your wisdom this afternoon. We are now at the beginning of chapter 5. We haven't gone through the entire thing yet. And Sister Denise has shared with us her understanding of words like renunciation, non-attached action, what it means to apply these two aspects in one's daily life, and how to connect with God to receive power to do both renunciation and to conduct oneself in a spiritual manner in life. So a very deep message. Thank you very much. And we will see you at the next episode, where we will continue to discuss chapter 5. Thank you, Sister Denise, and goodbye to you.